I suppose I might be a bit morbid. I'm curious if I'm the only one who's contemplated my own death and how I might receive some tragic news of an impending cancer or a heart condition that would foreshorten my life and give me immediate knowledge of my mortality. I don't think I'd be very good at dying. Some people are extremely graceful. Some people accept it with equanimity and use it as a teaching moment for their children and grandchildren, and it becomes forever part of their legacy. I think, like Dylan Thomas, I would just rage against the dying of the light. I'd be full of a lot of vinegar and a lot of anger. I do not think I'd be a very good paradigm of how to die with dignity and grace. I may find out differently, or I may just get hit by a bus and it may not be a problem. God forbid. But what I want to share with you today is that I've seen a lot of that. I've seen a lot of different ways that people react to health news, to their own mortality, to difficult circumstances, and it runs the gamut. And as a rabbi, I try to imagine what's the best way to cultivate a life such that, God forbid, when my time comes to suffer some indignity or the challenges of aging or mortality itself or a grief, that I can be good at it and that I can help people to be good at it. So I've thought a lot about that through observation, and then in this week's parasha, I think there's a lot of good information about that. So one of the mitzvot that we get in this week's parasha is when you reach the land, you're going to find all of these slaughter sites, all of the cultic sites of previous peoples, and you have to tear them down. And I'm going to read this in Hebrew because you need to hear the irony in the original Hebrew. So you're going to, Nitzavtem et ha-mizbachot v'shibarta et matzavetam. This is Deuteronomy 12, verse 3 and 4. V'ashrehem v'tisrafun be'esh v'sile Elohehem tegadeun v'ibadtem et shamam min ha-makom ha-hu lo ta'asun kein ladonai lehechem. So you should, I'm going to give you a rough paraphrase, when you reach the land, you're going to find all these different ways that people observed idolatry. You should burn them down and smash them and remove every evidence of them. And then the verse immediately thereafter says, don't do that for God. Which is very odd, because there's never a plan anywhere else in the Torah that you should smash God or smash God's tabernacle or smash the temple. So Rashi, one of our great medieval commentators, immediately notes this. He notes the quirkiness of the Hebrew itself, and he cites another source that Rabbi Ishmael once said, would it enter your mind ever that a Jew would tear down one of God's altars? Rather, what it means, he needs to point this out, that it's just metaphorical. What you shouldn't serve God the way you served those heathen and pagan and idols. Okay, so it does seem that one could very easily read these phrases as just a simple play of speech, as an idiom. They're not, though, because roughly at the same time, within a century or so, Maimonides takes up the question himself. He says, there is an actual question of halakha. What would happen if you were to smash one of God's altars? And he defines it very clearly in his law code, the Mishnah Torah, as an active prohibition, that one cannot actively smash one of God's altars. Which suggests to me, I mean, anytime you see a law, you can imagine that someone was breaking that law first and that people needed to be warned, that's not okay, you can't do that. Some things are pretty obvious. Murder we would rule out, but other laws do have precedence. Why would it even enter someone's mind to smash one of God's holy places? And I think if you ponder that for a little while, you realize you've thought of it too. You thought it would be nice to smash something holy. It would be nice to take vengeance on God when we feel that God is distant or alienated from us, that we don't feel close, that we would act out in some way to smash the things we can't hold. So I think what the experience there is that when we can't have something, there's a bit of spite in us. You know, every human being would take vengeance on the things that he or she can't have. In the language of psychology, we just call that a resentment, that you'd act out against what you don't get. And as I mentioned, this week's parasha is so deeply connected to charity that the Talmud notices that smashing or worshiping an idol is just like not giving someone charity. That if you shut your eye against a request for tzedakah, it's like you're one who worships an idol. That there is something in us that's stingy and, I think the word is pecunious, and desirous of resentment and desirous of holding our own and not giving to people if they won't give to us. Holding people with resentment, holding up our grudges, having grudges at all. Now that's what the idea of smashing an idol, smashing God's altar, I think really comes from, is this idea that if God doesn't do what we want, we would act violently towards God, which is, of course, on the surface of it, insanity. God's not going to care. That, I think, is the piece of me and the piece of many of us that I think would make a very good, poor death, where when we would receive that bad news, when we would struggle with unfairness of life, whether it's an early diagnosis of a deadly disease or the loss of a loved one, we would just rage and blame God and shout and scream through the night, which is normal, which is healthy, but ultimately doesn't get us very far. And just focusing on the resentments and being stingy with what we give as a result is really not a recipe for a very healthy or warm or full life. So what? What do you do about that? What's the alternative? How do you steer yourself away from rage? And I've had a couple of really nice pastoral conversations in my office and elsewhere this week about people who have resentments or struggles. And I said, I'm a really wrong person to ask because I'm still angry at things people did to me when I was 17. You know, and I don't think I'm alone. My mother even said she still holds grudges. It's a bad habit. It's a bad habit, and every fiber of my body cries out and says, you're not doing yourself any good by holding this grudge. You're not doing yourself any good by being angry and resentful. But it's not easy to turn it off. So I'm going to suggest a different strategy through the Parsha. So the very first words of the Parsha are, Re'eh anochi noten lifnechem hayom bracha uchlala. Look. Look, today I'm giving you something. I'm giving you a blessing or a curse, which is echoed in Deuteronomy 30. I give you life and death. Choose life. Right? So again, Maimonides thinks about this other line from the Torah, and he draws a very clear conclusion, as a philosopher would in the Neo-Aristotelian tradition, as he is. He comes out of the lines of Greek thinkers, that we have free choice, that the whole point of Torah and this verse is to say, you can do what you want with life. You could go for blessing or you could go for curse. You could go for life, you could go for death. Those are the lines in Deuteronomy. And that freedom of choice, free will, really as a philosopher would call it, is a fundamental principle of Torah. I mean, without it, there's no point in mitzvot. Telling you what to do and punishing you accordingly would have no real meaning if you didn't have a choice whether or not to do the right thing. It's sort of self-evident that that has to be the underlying premise of Torah, that we have free will. Otherwise, God telling us what to do is meaningless. There's no point in identifying someone as good or evil if they have no choice, if there's just predetermination in a Calvinist sense. So that's a piece. We have a choice not to be angry. We have a choice to focus on something else. We have a choice to move out of our resentments. The question is how? So I'm going to go back to that line, Re'eh anochi noten lifnechem hayom bracha v'chalala, uchlala, uklala. There were various translations of the Torah into Greek and into Aramaic, some of the early languages that our forefathers spoke. It was, the project of translating Torah is an old one, and one of the translations was into Aramaic, but what was interesting in translation projects was they did a lot of tweaking. It wasn't the way we think of it today as a neutral translation. They would fix certain theological problems. So this, I don't think, is a fix as much as just an interesting translation. Yonatan, in his Aramaic translation, says roughly, I give you today blessing and its transmutation. Anyone remembers Calvin and Hobbes, they should remember what transmutation was. It was the ability to modify or to turn or to polymorph something into something else. So what Yonatan, the Aramaic translator, is saying is that you can have blessing or you can mess it up. You can change it. With your own sight, with that re'eh, the very first important word of our parasha, you get the choice. You can, if you want to, have the transmutation, resentment, stinginess. You can hold back because you are angry with God, you're angry with your fellow person, you're angry with your congregation or your community, or you can live a fuller life. And again, I don't know how. I don't know how to let go of resentments. I don't know how to let go of anger. It's not really possible. I don't think so exactly. What you can do is turn your attention. That's why we say re'eh. Look, stare, focus. So what do you focus on? What are the people in my experience who have positive, life-affirming lives and who struggle mightily with their own mortality and who are shining examples to me of how to die with grace and dignity? Gene Bochnick, Leon Hasden recently, for example, others less recently. How do they do it? How do they do it? What did they do? Well, a couple of them were athletes, but that's a question for another day. I think they were just focused on gratitude. You know, there was someone who came into my office this week physically impaired, and I was so upset to see this person who had been formerly quite vigorous limping. And the person really didn't share in my upset. The person wasn't angry. The person wasn't especially distressed. I mean, normally distressed. I was more shaken by it. And this person said, you know, I had many great years of physical vigor. And even now, as my body's capacities change, so maybe I'll go to different places. Maybe I'll see more movies. Maybe I'll do more of something that doesn't require that physical vigor, but I'll get to experience a different part of life. So that's the trick, to be generous and grateful. Not easy. It's not easy. I'll leave you a few ideas about how to do that. So in that commentary about, that I mentioned, the Aramaic translation of the first verse about blessing and its transmutation, the last of the Chabad rabbis, the Lubavitcher rabbi, Menachem Mendel Schneerson said, you know, Moses gives the children of Israel the power of sight to perceive that the true nature of evil is nothing more than a distortion of good. And when you see it as it is, when you see it as just a perversion, you can refocus, you can reshape, you can redraw the picture. My words, not his. And then I want to leave you with a story of a strange and famous person in our tradition. I don't know if he really existed. There's some evidence online that seems to link him to a real king, but there's this guy named King Munbaz, which I think, if Jack were here, he'd have more to say about him. But to me, his name is so silly that I feel like they're making someone up anyway. But there's a possibility that he was Munbaz II, a first century king of Adiabene. It sounds like vaguely Ethiopian, but I don't think it is. And his story is sort of like a Midas, the story, our version of the King Midas story, someone who had fabulous wealth and sort of didn't know what to do with it. So the story in the Talmud is that King Munbaz squandered all his treasures, and the treasures put away by all of his ancestors feeding the poor during years of hunger. And I want to go back to that line about the connection between tzedakah and curses, that's a connection between tzedakah and altar worship, idol worship, that what we do in the holy realm is reflected by what we do in our day-to-day realm. So there's something there already about King Munbaz, that he has a generosity of spirit towards his fellow person that translates somehow as a positive relationship with God. Which is odd, because I think he's presented in a lot of stories as sort of a fool, as sort of a foil. But in this story, it's a very positive one. His brothers and his father's family ganged up on him and said, you know, your ancestors stored treasure, and they added to the treasure stored by their ancestors, and you squander them. I'm immediately thinking of Donald and Fred Trump, and that's another story for another day. You know, you can do a lot with your inheritance. You can give it away, you can keep it, you can increase it, you can invest it, you can gamble it. So he says to them, he defends his charitable giving in excess, you know, in excessive charitable giving, with these things that are very Jewish. He says, my ancestors stored below, meaning that they used to store things in treasure houses. I store above. My good merits are stored in heaven. My ancestors stored in a place where a foreign hand could reach them, meaning if I were conquered, you know, the Babylonians would have stolen all my money. I stored in a place where no foreign hand can reach them. You know, once you do charity, no one can take it away from you. My ancestors stored things that do not bear fruit. I stored things that bear fruit. Now, if you're a stock market investor, you can quibble with that, maybe. My ancestors hoarded money, and I hoarded souls. My ancestors stored for others, and I stored for myself, myself being my own future well-being. My ancestors stored for this world, and I store for the world to come. The people that I have seen who figure out how to do it right, who figure out how to live a life of openness and generosity and gratitude, that's a big part of their attitude. That all these slights we get in this world, that all the times our investments don't pay off, that all the times we lose money or lose a friend or lose a bit of our health, that's just a trivia. That the real things that matter are deeper issues of spirit and deeper issues of legacy and deeper issues of productivity and generativity. And the question is, at whatever age you find yourself in this room, and we have a nice broad span of ages in this room, how soon can you do that? How soon can you be that person whose life is about generativity and generosity and gratitude and not a life of stinginess and anger and resentment? And I'll let you know when I get there.